Good evening. I'm Dorothy Graves, and this is Science Cafe Little Rock. We are here on 89.1 KUAR the fourth Tuesday of every month from 6:05 to 6:30 to talk about a science topic and give you the chance to call in with your questions. Our studio lines are open this evening. If you have a question, our number is 501-569-8494. That's here in Central Arkansas, 569-8494. Tonight, we are talking about gravitational waves. My guest joining me in the studio is Brett Lamer, Assistant Professor of Physics at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. He drove all the way down here from Fayetteville today. Brett, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So, can you give us some background on what our conversation is going to be tonight? What's a gravitational wave? What are we talking about? Are we talking about gravity? What are we talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a gravitational wave is obviously related to gravity. And one of Einstein's most famous contributions is to frame gravity in terms of geometry. And so he's framed gravity as a warpage in space and time. Okay, and so gravitational waves are basically waves along within space that propagate due to changes in gravity. And so most of gravitational waves come from the acceleration of really big objects. And in the case of gravitational waves that we've detected so far, they're black holes that are orbiting each other at really, really fast speeds. And so one way to imagine this is gravity is oftentimes imagined as like putting something on a trampoline. Okay, you can imagine space is the trampoline. If you put a bowling ball down, you distort the surface of the trampoline. And so if you have two objects that are kind of orbiting each other, moving around on that trampoline, you can imagine that if you're outside of those two objects orbiting each other, you're going to get ripples. Okay, and so that's the analogy, a good analogy anyway, to describe what gravitational waves are. It's the propagation of waves of gravity, essentially.
And we're talking about something that happens. You mentioned black holes. So
right.
those things colliding are not here on Earth. We're talking about big things far away.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And the reason I mentioned black holes is because these are the most extreme objects, and these are the objects that we can now detect gravitational waves from.
So I know when I was reading a little bit of background for this, because space is not my area, or astronomy is not my area, more biology in terms of my background. I've heard the analogy to electromagnetic waves. Mm-hmm. Is that just kind of in concept with the waves, or are there more similarities or differences there?
There's similarities and differences for sure. There's similarities in the sense that waves have wavelengths and they have intensities. And so gravitational waves have both of those. Electromagnetic waves have both of those. Gravitational waves are the propagation of gravity, but electromagnetic waves are the propagation of electromagnetism. Okay, and so it's somewhat different for sure. They certainly share properties.
So how long ago did we learn about gravitational waves? Is this something that's been around for centuries or relatively new in our understanding of the world?
It's actually been around for about a century. The idea of gravitational waves came almost a year after Einstein published his famous paper on general relativity, which is what I was talking about, describing gravity in these geometric terms. And so it sort of immediately fell out of Einstein's equations of general relativity that if you have accelerating masses, then you will produce waves. And so that also has an analogy to how electromagnetic waves are produced. It's accelerating charges. Like if you accelerate an electron or something like that, you produce an electromagnetic wave.
If you're just joining me, you are listening to Science Cafe Little Rock here on KUAR 89.1. We are taking your calls. The number here in the studio, 569-8494, talking with Brett Lamer. He's an assistant professor of physics from the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. So can we feel gravitational waves here on Earth?
We cannot. Gravitational waves are very weak because the objects that produce them are very far away. If we were, however, very close to a merging set of black holes, then we would certainly feel them. But the strongest gravitational wave signals that we've experienced thus far have been very, very tiny. And you know, you can almost quantify this as the, you know, the average motion of a gravitational wave by the distortion of space is something like a small fraction of an atomic nucleus. And so it's very, very tiny. You wouldn't feel that at all.
So how do we know that they exist? Because I know after Einstein sort of threw this idea out there, he went through a period where he was like, no, maybe they don't exist. But right. You know, we understand that they exist now. How do we know that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know that Einstein ever doubted the existence of gravitational waves per se, but I think he was very skeptical that we'd ever detect them.
Okay.
And he doubted
okay.
the existence of black holes, certainly. And you know, I'm actually extremely surprised that we've now detected gravitational waves. You know, I remember reading about the LIGO experiment when I was a graduate student roughly a decade ago, and just thinking, wow, this is Mission Impossible. I'll never see this thing actually detect something in my lifetime. But I'm astounded that that's actually happened. And so the reason that we know they exist is because we have detected their signatures now. Just over a year ago, in September of 2015, the first direct signature of gravitational waves was detected through the LIGO experiment. But I should say that gravitational waves and their signatures have been confirmed, at least for decades. So in the 70s and 80s, the effects of gravitational waves on other objects were observed. And so there was this famous system where you had two neutron stars, you know, that are pulsars, and these are extremely dense stars that have died and left behind, you know, ridiculously dense cores. And so you're talking like taking a sugar cube sized piece of material and having that weigh like a mountain or something like that. You know, so these are really, really dense objects, and there were two pulsars that were in orbit around each other, and This is important because pulsars are very good in terms of how they keep very accurate time. And so you can time them very well. And so just by watching these pulsars orbit each other over the years, they found that their orbits were getting smaller and smaller. So they were getting closer and closer to each other. And they were getting closer and closer to each other in a way that is only predicted by them losing energy from gravitational waves. And so this was actually the subject of a Nobel Prize in 1993. And so the actual...
And who got the Nobel Prize? Do you remember?
Yeah. So this was Holson Taylor. So, okay. You know, I don't recall the first names exactly.
That's okay.
But yeah. So this has been known for a long time. Those objects, I should add, are not going to merge together for like 3 million years or something like that. So this is very different from the types of objects that we've now observed with LIGO, which are bigger objects, black holes that have come together and coalesced into one bigger black hole.
Well, I want to come back to LIGO mm-hmm. in just a minute. We have a caller on the line, Bruce from North Little Rock. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hey, Bruce, what's your question?
My question is, what instrument is used to measure these waves, and when they are measured, can you define a frequency or a range of frequencies in hertz at which they oscillate?
Yes. So the instruments that have been used to detect the gravitational waves are called interferometers. Okay, so LIGO has two facilities, one in Hanford, Washington, and one in Livingston, Louisiana. And each of these facilities consists of an interferometer in which you shine a laser beam, like a really powerful laser beam, that's split. One of the laser beams goes down one way, and then the other beam goes perpendicular to that laser beam. And each of these laser beams travel about 4 kilometers to a mirror, and then the laser beam comes all the way back to the origin, and then they mix, the light mixes and interferes with each other and causes this pattern at a detector.
So it's like a standing wave that occurs.
Yes. Yeah. So they set up this standing wave pattern at a detector,
right.
And then when a gravitational wave comes through, a gravitational wave has this property where it stretches in one direction and then compresses in the adjacent, or I'm sorry, the perpendicular direction, and so that's why they have this thing set up. So the light beams are going in perpendicular directions. So the mirrors on one of the lengths will be a little bit closer, and the mirrors on the other link will be a little bit further, and that interference pattern will change, and it will change, according to how the wave is progressing through the detector. And so,
go ahead, Bruce.
Okay, no, I was just saying that's fascinating. That's brilliant, and we have one of these facilities in Livingston, Louisiana, and I assume you've visited that facility.
That's correct. Yeah. So there's one there, and then there's a second one. Which the second one, having two is very important here. So there's another one in Hanford, Washington, in the state of Washington. And so the first event produced two detections, and the wave. And so you asked before, what is the frequency in hertz? It's actually in the order of 100 hertz. So so it ends up actually being in the audio. Yeah. And the waveform is such that it's not just one constant wave length. It changes with time. So it starts out as a lower frequency, and this is associated with the black holes being relatively far away in their orbits.
Right.
And as they get closer and closer to each other, the frequency increases. And so if you were to listen, and people do this a lot with the first signal, you can actually use a computer to play back in audio the first gravitational wave detection signal, and it sort of sounds like, and then goes from low frequency to high frequency, and then it just cuts off. And so that characteristic signal is one that you expect to see for merging black holes, and they saw it in both detectors at an extremely high confidence rate. And so to get one of these things by accident, get these types of signals by accident, you're expecting that to happen once every 200,000 years.
But they saw it in symmetry.
Roughly in symmetry,
detectors.
Yeah. Yes. It wasn't, there is another interesting aspect to this. It wasn't completely in symmetry. It was off by 7 milliseconds. So the reason for that is because there is a distance between the detectors. And so basically the wave washed over one of the detectors, and then 7 milliseconds later it washed over the other detector.
Oh, because this direction of travel, it was not exactly perpendicular to the Earth, so it came across one and then hit the second.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
Yep, and so that can tell us roughly what direction it came from. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bruce. And if you have a question, our number here, 569-8494, area code 501, 569-8494, talking about gravitational waves with Brett Lamer, assistant professor of physics at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. So you mentioned two detections. So were you talking about the symmetrical detections or one set of detections and then another one a little bit later?
Okay, yeah. Well, it corresponds to the same event.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's... you detected it in one detector at one time, and then a little bit later, 7 milliseconds later, you detected in the other one. It's just because these gravitational waves, in the same sense as light, they travel at the speed of light, and so there's a delay between when it hits one detector and when it hits the other one, just because it has a little bit of time to travel.
So was it hard to figure out how to build these instruments?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I
guess that's probably a stupid question. Because sometimes...
The concept itself, though, has been... my understanding is that this concept has been known for decades.
Right.
It's just that producing an instrument that's sensitive enough to detect the types of events that are out there that are producing the strongest gravitational wave signatures... That was a major, major undertaking.
So we knew what we needed, but it took us a long time to figure out how to execute it.
Yeah, that's right. And so one thing, I make it kind of sound simple. How you just bounce some laser beams off of mirrors and that kind of thing. But if you just kind of think about it a little bit, there's all kinds of sources of noise that you have to get rid of. If a car drives by, then you'll have some, shaking of the facility, and so there's all these things that you have to worry about. Shining a laser beam 4 kilometers you know, to a mirror and then having it come back and having a lot of power. You know, that's another thing. You know, so they have a lot of tricky things that they've built into the system. The mirrors themselves weigh like 88 pounds, and then they're suspended in a way that, you know, they're sort of insulated from noise from the outside. They have a corrective system, so they know, you know, from like seismic data and outside noises, they know how to kind of correct the mirrors for noises that they know about. And so they have to do all these things to get the sensitivity down to a level where they can actually detect something that's, you know, a real astrophysical event.
We have another caller, Cody from Cabot. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Cody. Thanks for calling. What's your question for Brett?
Hi. I'm a student in a STEM field here in the state of Arkansas, a college student. And I wanted to ask if there were any research or internship or job-related opportunities for interested people here in the state.
In this area?
Yeah, in the state of Arkansas, sure.
No, I mean in this particular area of research?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, in this area of physics, for sure, yes. But also local to the area.
Yeah, okay. So which STEM field are you...
I was a liberal arts major. I changed to a math major, but I have interest in physics and things like that as well.
Okay. Yeah. I mean the typical path. So there is some, you know, it varies a lot. I'll just say that much. You know, research opportunities, in the state of Arkansas, at least, can come in a few different forms in this particular area of research. So you know, there are sometimes, postdoctoral research positions. If you go to, say, a graduate school in a physics or, you know, physics department, that would have to be a physics department in the state of Arkansas, and they have an astronomy, you know, people who work in astronomy, like myself, you know, if you're in a graduate program, you know, sometimes you can, you would do research in this type of area for your dissertation, you know, for your thesis. And
do you
that
take
kind of
students
thing.
And general people
so
in your?
So I do take students, but I do have limits. Yeah, so I've
sure.
reached, I've currently reached my limits, but that does change a lot. So that's why
okay.
I say it varies.
But in general,
for sure.
you would say to look at astronomy or astrophysics programs.
Yes, and if you're not limited to the state of Arkansas, there are many across the country. Mm-hmm. And so I am not originally from Arkansas. I did my PhD work at Penn State University, you know, before, and then I worked at NASA at Goddard before coming here. But yeah.
And you could certainly go to college and stay, go out of state for graduate school, or, you know, as you sort of
right.
refine the area that's of interest to you, because there are certainly lots of subspecialties within astronomy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate you.
Sure.
Thanks for your call, Cody. Our number here, 569-8494, area code 501-569-8494, talking gravitational waves with Brett Lamer, assistant professor of physics at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. So I want to take a few minutes for you to kind of shift focus and talk about, you know, gravitational waves. You know all about it. It's intimately related with what you really focus on. But tell us a little bit about your area of research and what you do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my area of research, yeah, as you say, is intimately related to gravitational wave sources. At least the ones that are currently being detected. And, you know, I can say, like, the first gravitational wave source that was detected was truly astounding. Okay, so this was basically two very massive black holes. And these were 29 times the mass of the sun and then 36 times the mass of the sun. And they merged together and they formed a black hole that was 62 times the mass of the sun. And so if you do the math, you'll think, well, I don't know what I'm doing. You would add those two together and you get
right.
65 times the mass of the sun, right?
Right.
So you're missing three solar masses. Mm-hmm. And what happened was when those two black holes merged together, they sort of lost weight in the total mass black hole because they radiated away energy and three times the mass of the sun worth of energy. And so this comes from Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared. People know that one. Mm-hmm. Convert mm-hmm. three times the mass of the sun into energy. Okay, that's three times the mass of the sun times C squared. That's a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. And so that radiates away. So that was truly astounding. The thing about it, though, is that, you know, the black holes have a history to them. Okay, now we know from that, you know, from the data at least, that that merging happened in a galaxy that is 1.3 billion light years away. Okay, so this happened actually more than a billion years ago. And those black holes, though, they formed from stars that were once normal stars. Not normal in the sense that, you know, they're like the sun, but they were a lot bigger than the sun, but they were normal stars. So you once formed stars early in the universe that were really big, and those stars evolved and formed black holes, and then those black holes eventually merged. And actually, if you trace the history back, we think that this very first system would have originally formed when the universe was only 2 billion years old, and now the universe is like 13.7 billion years old. So this is an event that must have happened in the very early universe. And in between, okay, that whole stage, there was the two black holes coming together, the formation of the normal stars. There was events that, you know, happened in between. You would have had the first two stars would have been normal stars, then one would have formed a black hole first, and then the other star would have been dumping material onto that black hole. And that process is something that I study a lot. That produces what's called an X-ray binary, where you basically have one of these big black holes, or it can even be a neutron star that's stripping matter away from its companion and lighting up and being, you know, and being extremely luminous. And so I study X-ray binaries that are in galaxies, other galaxies. It turns out that the X-ray detectors right now are very, very good in terms of isolating where these things are, much, much better than the gravitational wave detectors at the moment. So the gravitational wave detectors can tell you that, oh, it's in that hemisphere of the sky or something like that. But X-ray detectors, we can see several sources in a galaxy. So there's very, very good imaging, and you can study populations of those objects. And so the work that I'm doing is trying to make a connection between all of these things. You know, how you form a bunch of stars, the stars evolve, many of the stars will be in binaries, some of those will produce these X-ray binaries, and then some of those will eventually become gravitational wave sources.
So it's all related.
That's right.
All right, we have one more caller, Dave from Conway. What's your question for Brett?
Hey, Brett. I was wondering, do the gravitational waves appear to adhere to, I'm thinking, the standard model, like limited by the speed of light, that sort of thing?
Yes. Yeah, they are limited to the speed of light. And again, that is something that we did observe with this first gravitational wave detection in September of 2015. There was a bit of a delay between when it happened at one detector and when it was detected at the other detector, and that delay was consistent with the speed of light.
Okay, yeah. So yep. The 7 milliseconds added up to at the distance came up to the speed of light.
Maybe? That's right. Yeah, it's about 2,000 miles.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for your question, Dave. So. Tell us really quickly, we only have a couple of minutes left, about the ways that we observe those X-ray binaries.
Oh, sure. Okay, so they're actually...
You said they're much better than the gravitational wave observers.
They've come a long way. So there are these X-ray telescopes in space. So X-rays don't make it all the way down to the surface of the Earth because the atmosphere absorbs them, luckily for us, or we'd have very bad sunburns. And so, you know, we have to put these X-ray detectors in space. And there are a few that, you know, we're fortunate right now to have several that are operating. The one kind of flagship mission of NASA is called Chandra, the Chandra X-ray Observatory. And then there's another that I use as well that's also a NASA mission called New Star. And so these observatories work in, it's similar in the way that they detect light to how, like the Hubble Space Telescope detects light. You have a camera that consists of several pixels, and then light will come and illuminate those cameras. It's just that X-ray detectors or X-ray telescopes themselves work quite a bit differently from the way that the Hubble would work, in the sense that they don't focus light by using a big mirror that's curved and that sort of thing. They actually use little shells where the X-rays kind of skip along these shells and down to the detectors in a way that they're focused. And so the one that I use the most, it would be Chandra X-ray Observatory. That was launched in 1999. And it's a really fascinating story, but it's a whole other story. X-ray astronomy started in the 60s. And at that time, actually, the detectors were just about as bad as, I say bad, but no, it's great that we've detected gravitational waves, but yeah, they've evolved. So they were sort of like at the quality of the gravitational wave detectors in terms of finding positions. And they've gone all the way to sort of quality that's similar to Hubble. Not quite as good, but similar.
Well, Brett, thank you so much for being here. If you would like to hear more from Brett, we are headed over to Whole Hog Cafe in West Little Rock, where he will be joined by two other panelists to expand our discussion on gravitational waves and X-ray binaries and black holes and all the fun stuff. Scott Austin, Associate Professor of Physics at the University of Central Arkansas, and Damon Spade, Associate Professor of Physics at Hendricks College, will be joining us. So thank you for listening to Science Cafe Little Rock. And once again, thank you, Brett Lamer, for being my guest.
Thank you for having me.
And for KUAR 89.1 and Science Cafe, I'm Dorothy Graves.
This is 89.1 KUAR Little Rock, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. KUAR is news and culture for Arkansas. Show your support by becoming a sustaining member at KUAR.org.